Last summer, I got obsessed with the many mushrooms I'd see on my hikes in a nearby forest, so I downloaded an app on my phone to help identify them, and it was like I'd stumbled into Alice's Wonderland. Just the names alone were great. American Slippery Jack, Crested Coral, Stinking Brittlegill, Golden Chanterelle, Scurfy Twiglet, Scarlet Waxcap. I was hooked, partly because I had just read Merlin Sheldrake's book, Entangled Life, which is a deep dive into the weird and wonderful world of mushrooms and other fungi. What's astonishing is how ubiquitous they are. As Sheldrake writes, they are inside you and around you. They're eating rock, making soil, digesting pollutants, nourishing and killing plants, producing foods, making medicines, manipulating animal behavior and influencing the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. I'm Steve Paulson, and I want to welcome you to a new episode in our series on kinship with the more than human world. This is different from what you normally hear on To the Best of Our Knowledge. It's a single long interview, which we just don't have time for on the radio show. And I have to say, we cover a lot of ground in this conversation. My guest, Merlin Sheldrake, is a tropical biologist, an avid fermenter and brewer, and very much a big-picture thinker. He says the fungal world challenges a lot of our preconceptions about what form a living organism can take. For one thing, fungi often live in web-like networks. Think of the mycelial threads that can stretch underground across an entire forest. As Sheldrake says, fungi play games with individuality. They can also blow your mind. We'll talk about the strange properties of psychedelic mushrooms, and also the stoned ape theory, the rather outrageous idea that magic mushrooms helped shape the evolution of human consciousness. So buckle up and enjoy the ride. Here is Merlin Sheldrake. Merlin, fungi seem to go way back in your life. When did you first get interested in them?
I think there are lots of levels, lots of ways in for me. One was as a child, thinking about decomposition, how things change, how things rot. I would take compost into the gardens, the compost heap, and it would turn into soil. I'd see leaves, they would turn into soil, and blocks of wood would decompose. And how this process of decomposition happened would puzzle me. And someone explained to me after a while that this was because of fungi. And so I became interested in these organisms which are out of sight, but which are responsible for so much. And I became very curious about their astonishing power, their transformative power. Well, as a child, I was always interested in mushrooms, of course, and watched them spring up out of the ground and they grow so fast and then vanish again, mysteriously from where they came.
Well, going back to your childhood, you tell a wonderful story in your book about how your father, Rupert Sheldrake, who is himself a biologist, introduced you to how things decompose.
Yes. So I had piles of leaves in the garden that I would create by raking them into heaps. And I'd hide in these piles of leaves and jump into them from the branches of a tree. It was a kind of den for me, a place to hide and a place to explore. The leaf piles would shrink over time, though, and it became harder to submerge myself. And so I would inquire. And in one of these inquiries, when I was asking my father about, you know, more about decomposition, which seems to me such a strange thing to understand as a child, how this could happen. So he proposed an experiment where we got a plastic bottle and cut off the top and put layers of soil and sand and dead leaves and then added some earthworms. And so you could see through the side of the bottle, the clear plastic of the bottle, see these layers, which were initially very distinct, had these sharp edges. You could see them starting to mix and blend into one another. And he explained that this was being conducted by worms, this process of mixing and blending. But there were creatures smaller than worms, very much smaller than worms, that did similar things. And so this was a way to get an intuitive sense of how this kind of transformative mixing could take place. And it really helped me to get a sense of what was going on in my leaf piles.
Well, one thing that I find so interesting about that story is I think most people would find sort of this slimy, rotting stuff to be kind of revolting. And until very recently, I think actually most people, at least in the West, in Western culture, have considered fungi revolting. I mean, this is the stuff that stinks, that can make you sick. But something has happened very recently, and fungi, especially mushrooms, are now very cool. Can you explain what has happened? Why has all of this changed?
I think it's important to note that mushrooms have been pretty cool in other parts of the world for some time. In East Asian countries, in China and Japan and Korea, for example, mushrooms are enjoyed as a great delicacy and often in quite slimy preparations of the sort that might revulse people in England or America. So cultural attitudes to mushrooms vary, but it's certainly true that in England and in North America that there's a kind of suspicion of mushrooms and fungi, and that might be to do with the fact that some of them are poisonous, and it might have to do with the fact that mushrooms associate with decomposing matter and so have the sort of filth label. But it's changed recently for, I think, a number of reasons. And one of those reasons is that we know more about the fungal world. And this is a really big deal because, you know, it's often the case that, that humans are suspicious of that which we are ignorant about. And so the more we can dispel our ignorance, the more we can learn about the amazing habits and tendencies of these organisms. But that's not it. I think there are other reasons too. Psychedelics, I think the resurgence of interest in psychedelics is a big one. Much of the recent work on psychedelics has taken place with psilocybin, which is produced by so-called magic mushrooms. And
that's really in the resurgence in interest in psychedelics is really over the last decade or two.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the amazing power of psilocybin to change people's minds generates a curiosity about the organisms that produce it. But other reasons. Fungi live their lives as mycelium, which are these living, branching, fusing networks of tubular cells. And networks have become a master concept, and network thinking is used to make sense of all sorts of subjects, not just the digital networks of the World Wide Web and the physical networks of routers and cables that make up the internet, but all sorts of other areas of human interest. And so there's a kind of network thing, I think, that fungi have that tune into to some of this zeitgeist.
Well, we should talk about what exactly fungi are, because I think for the non-expert, we usually do think about mushrooms, but I know they are only a tiny portion of all the fungi out there. So what are fungi?
They're a kingdom of life. So that's as broad a category as animals or plants, a very diverse kingdom of life. There are lots of ways to be a fungus, and a very small part of the fungal world, a very small number of fungal species produce mushrooms. Mushrooms are the fruiting bodies of fungi, the place where they make spores in order to disperse themselves, a bit like plants make seeds to disperse themselves. But most fungi live most of their lives as mycelium, which are branching, fusing networks of tubular cells. And that's how fungi feed. So they're not like plants in the sense that plants photosynthesize and make their own energy from sunlight and carbon dioxide. They're more like animals in their nutritional strategy, in the sense that they have to find food in the world, ready-made, as it were.
When you say they feed through their mycelium, how do they do that?
Well, mycelium is the way that they insinuate themselves within their source of food. So an animal like us might find some food and put it inside their body, but a fungus will put their body inside the food. And to do this, they grow as these very flexible networks, these fluid networks called mycelial networks. And that allows them to tunnel into their food source, upon which they secrete digestive enzymes and then absorb the digested surroundings into themselves.
What would be some examples of that, of how they go inside their food source and then start eating?
Well, there are lots of cases. So if you think about a rotting log, for example, if you break open a rotting log, you might well find fungal mycelium there. All of what you see, the decaying wood, a spongy decaying wood, that's been made spongy and pale white or brown, depending, by the activity of fungi secreting enzymes and absorbing what they can. Fungi can digest very recalcitrant materials. There are wonderful studies which show the traces left behind on minerals as fungi have etched their way into these rocks, and you can see the grooves left behind after they have had their way with these mineral
rocks.
Well,
isn't that what lichens basically do? I mean, the lichens that we see growing on rocks, I mean, they're kind of eating the rocks, aren't they?
That's right. Many lichens are eating rocks. Not all, but many do. And they're able to do so by the force of their growth, which breaks up the substrate physically, but also by producing acids and other chemicals which help to dissolve and bind the minerals of the rock and convert them into a form that the fungus or lichen can absorb.
Now, you said that fungi are their own kingdom in the kingdom of life. I mean, they're plants, they're animals, and there are fungi. And I think most of us assume that, you know, okay, they're not exactly plants, but they're kind of like plants. I mean, they look sort of like a different kind of plant. I think we don't quite appreciate how radically different they are from plants. Can you explain that?
Well, they're actually more closely related to animals than plants. If you look at an evolutionary tree, you would see the fungi branch off at a point closer to the animal branch than the plant branch. So they're different from plants in a number of ways. The main way, as I said, is the way that they source their food, which is by digesting things in the world rather than by photosynthesizing, as most plants do. Not all plants photosynthesize. Some have lost the ability to do so because they depend on their relationships with fungi. Yeah, we think of them as sort of plant-like because they were actually considered to be plants until the 1960s when they won their independence, taxonomically speaking, and they were recognized as a distinct kingdom. But I think they've been lumped in with the plants because they share some of these characteristics in that they tend to grow places rather than go places as an animal might.
Right.
They have a sort of a vegetative lifestyle, and you could mistake a mycelial network for a kind of tangled system of roots. So there are some loose analogies, and they face similar challenges as being organisms that don't run around with motile bodies. And so they face challenges a bit like the challenges that plants would face. For example, with a plant, it would make no sense to have a brain as an animal does, because you'd be very vulnerable to a herbivore coming and just eating it. So plants, like fungi, tend to have very decentralized bodies where things can regenerate very easily. You can destroy 90% of 99% of a fungal network, just take 1% and it can regenerate a whole new network. So there's a great flexibility that comes from their sedentary lifestyles.
Well, and if you actually think about it, it's sort of mind-blowing because some of these mycelial networks are huge. I mean, they can go for miles, actually. I mean, the biggest ones. To think that somehow it's all part of one. Well, actually, that's an interesting question. I mean, is this just one organism, this large mycelial network, or are they made up of lots of different organisms?
Well, it depends. Fungi play games with individuality. I think we tend to think about individuals as an unproblematic concept because, on the whole, we live in an individualistic society, and humans are relatively straightforward to detect as individuals because we, you know, have a body which is separate from another body. So we tend not to think about that too much, but fungi really play games with this because you can divide a mycelial network in two, and then you have two mycelial networks, but they will be genetically identical. So is that two fungi or two individuals? So is that one individual divided in two? If you take a fragment of that network and regenerate a whole other network similar, different networks can fuse and their genetic contents can mingle, making it difficult to define an individual on genetic grounds. And besides, fungi have all sorts of intimate symbiotic relationships through which they form functioning physiological bodies that are not made up of just the fungus or just their other partner, whether a plant or bacteria, but a whole consortium of organisms that contributes to the overall operation of that symbiotic organism, like a lichen. So when it comes to these really large fungal networks, like the networks of our malaria in Oregon, have received a lot of attention, and rightly right. So. These are assessed by, you know, genetics. It's a bit like paternity testing or forensic, looking at genetic fingerprints.
We should talk some about this particular mycelial network in Oregon. So it covers, 10 square kilometers? And apparently it's thousands of years old. And I guess the question is that one single living organism?
Yes. So the idea is that it is a single living organism because it is a single genotype. So it would be possible, for example, to take lots of different samples of this network at different points within this area, and you could find that it was all genetically identical. But you could also imagine a situation where that part of the network had been severed from other parts of the network. And then you say, well, is it actually contiguous, physiologically contiguous with the rest of the network? And then you'd have to do some soul searching about whether that counted as the same. But these really large organisms, they raise many questions, rather like the enormous networks of clonal seagrasses, for example, or aspens. This is such a different way of being from humans and our concepts.
Well, and I mean, going back to this idea of There's no brain, obviously. There's no single command center. There's no heart. I mean, it's sort of like there's no one place that kind of makes the whole thing go. And yet there's all this communication. I mean, there's signals constantly, messages, information being passed through the network. And you kind of wonder, how does that work? I mean, who makes that happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're so used to having centralized bodies and living in centralized societies that it's very difficult for us to understand this. But our brains didn't evolve their tricks from scratch and being electrically excitable, flexible networks as they are. They share a lot with many other types of organism who also form electrically excitable, flexible networks. And bacteria, even colonies of bacteria, can communicate with each other using waves of electrical excitation, a bit like the action potentials that pass through our nerves. Fungi certainly can also. So I think if we imagine the fungal network, this is obviously a loose analogy, but if you imagine a fungal network as not containing flexible networks like we do, but just being a flexible network that allows it to sense and respond to its environment. It's bathed in a flood of sensory information. It can integrate these data streams as a little bit everywhere at once and nowhere in particular.
I have to say, this gives a whole new meaning to the idea of kinship, you know, that ecologically we're all kind of related to each other. I mean, this takes it to a whole different level.
I think it's really important to think about the things that we share with organisms that we often think of as very distant from us, rather than the things that make us different. And we become very fixated on concepts like brains, and I can understand why, and it's difficult not to be. But when we think about the things that we share, like the ability to be electrically excited and to communicate through cell networks, then I think the living world opens up to us in a different kind of way. I find this a very helpful way to remind myself that I'm a part of this living world, not apart from it.
Well, there's been a lot of attention recently to how plants, trees, for instance, can kind of signal to each other. And apparently they often do this through the mycelial networks. I mean, that their root systems are connected to them, and they can signal that there is trouble. There's a predator around, or they're being attacked, or they're in need of more water or something like that. And somehow this information is passed, and the mycelium are part of that whole process. And it does raise the question, well, it raises the question of, are the mycelium just kind of like the cable line that these messages are being communicated through, or are the mycelium themselves somehow intelligent in some way?
I subscribe to views of intelligence that don't locate it by definition in animal brains. I think that intelligence involves information processing, making decisions, choosing between alternative courses of action, adjusting to one's environment. So I would think of fungal networks as intelligent in the sense that they're able to respond to their surroundings and to change their behavior in a way which is important for them.
But are they making decisions, or do they just have automatic responses to whatever the, I don't know, chemical, electrical signals are that they're getting?
I think there are lots of situations where fungi are very indeterminate. It's very hard to predict their behavior and their responses. And I think there are lots of situations where the options that fungi face, where they could realistically go one way or another. And so I would think of options as entailing decisions, whether or not those decisions are made in an animal brain or by a decentralized organism like a fungus. That doesn't strike me as too much of a problem. But when it comes to thinking about these shared networks with plants, I do think that the emphasis is perhaps a little unfair, or a little distorts the picture somewhat, because we think of plants as being connected by the fungal networks, as if plants were the routers in the internet and the fungi were the cables. But fungi are not just passive cables. Now, every link in one of these wood wide webs, as they've come to be known, every link is a fungus with a life of its own. And this fungus has its own needs and interests and history and evolutionary history. It's very much an agent in this relationship. Fungi can control the flow of material through their networks. And if you think about a mushroom growing, that's a hydraulic feat. You know, it's just water flowing into that certain area of a fungal network to inflate the mushroom with water. So that just illustrates the degree to which they can control flow through themselves. So if you take this view, then it looks somewhat different, because rather than one plant actively signaling to another plant, it becomes a situation where a fungus is connected to multiple plants, has a portfolio of plant partners, and the fungus can shift a little bit of nutrients over here to support this plant that might be sickening, or shift this sickening compound over here to a plant that might not have been exposed to a pest yet. Of course, it's very difficult to resolve cause and effect within living right. networks. And so the thing I really like to do is actually hold both of these in mind at once, to take a plant-centric view, a phytocentric view, and a mycocentric view, and to let both be true.
There's a number that you mentioned in your book that I just found astonishing, that there are something like 6 times as many fungal species as plant species. I mean, that kind of blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, that's just an estimate. Now, the estimated number of fungal species ranges from 2.2 to 3.8 million species, only about 8% of which have been described. So I think that forms
You're saying more than 90% of fungal species out there have not been scientifically identified.
That's right. So I think that really neatly summarizes our ignorance.
So there's been a lot of attention recently, really, especially in the last decade or so, about sort of trying to imagine the world from a plant's point of view. And I'm wondering if there's a comparable effort, maybe by you, to try to imagine it from the fungus point of view. I mean, what does the world look like from the perspective of a fungus? Do you try to do that?
I do try to do that. I don't have a great deal of confidence in my ability to succeed in doing so, but I feel like it's good manners to at least try to think about what life might be like for the organisms that we are in awe of. Well, imagine that you are a network, and that one part of you is growing inside the roots of a plant, inside the cells of a plant, and engaged in a very intimate cellular and molecular dialogue with this plant, producing plant growth hormones that change plant behavior, plants producing fungal growth hormones that can change fungal behavior. And that's just one little part of you. And then another part of you is growing into another plant root. And in fact, maybe 200 little branches of your network are growing to different roots, some of the same plants, some of different plants, all of which will be experiencing slightly different conditions at different moments in time. But they're all connected. And so part of that network will range out into the soil, and some of you might be totally embedded within a real bustle of activity as an animal body decays in a sort of wild orgy of microbial consumption. And so somehow there's a lot of experience going on. We're being in all of these different places at once. I think of our minds as being more like fungal networks in our bodies, because our minds are the most indeterminate parts of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And if you could draw a portrait of a mind, I think it would look maybe something like a fungal network. But mind maps certainly do. We can actually imagine this because our minds work in quite non-linear, parallel ways.
My guest is the biologist Merlin Sheldrake, the author of Entangled Life: How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures. This conversation is part of our series on kinship with the more than human world. Merlin, you are a tropical ecologist by training. Your PhD is based on your research on underground fungal networks in Panama. So obviously you're very steeped in the science. But there was something else I got as I was reading your book. It's a very sensuous read. I mean, all the smells and tastes and the sort of the feeling that you're digging in the dirt and the bubbling jars of alcohol that you have fermented. It really feels like you were inhabiting the world of fungi. I'm assuming that you did that as you were writing the book. I mean, how did you stay so close to the fungal world while you're working on this?
Well, I made an effort to, because I find they get very, if I'm sitting at my computer pushing around little buttons, I'm looking at digital characters all the time, which is what writing a book really is. It's very easy to become separated from the living world, the world of more than human organisms. And so I felt that I really had to maintain my contact with the fungal kingdom, because otherwise I'd just become too abstract and I'd just write a textbook. And so this involved going outside, involved burying my hands in the soil, involved running around with truffle hunters, it involved brewing and having a close relationship with yeasts and jars and bottles. And I found that this really helped to help me keep the focus steady on the mysteries of fungal life, on the things that we can't easily explain, the things that are invoke a sort of awe and astonishment and curiosity. So I found it a helpful process only to be practically engaged. I'm tasting, you know, I like tasting things, smelling things.
You eat a lot of mushrooms, I take it.
I eat mushrooms for at least one meal a day. Yeah, when I was writing the book, I still tried to do so. But that was I drink mushroom teas.
That's a lot of mushrooms. Well, I saw a photo of how you grew mushrooms on one of the first copies of your published book when it came off the press.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is exactly what I was saying. You know, this was the way of making a real statement of the fact that this book is part of the world that I've been discussing.
Did you eat your book then?
Yeah. I ate the mushrooms that grew from the book, so partly to eat my words, because I'd always I'd always loved the idea of eating my words, but also to turn, you know, what was largely a digital process into something analog, and something so analog that I could eat it.
And clearly you have spent a lot of time experimenting with various forms of fermentation, especially brews of alcohol.
Yes, I find this a really helpful way to get new perspective on ecology more generally. If you're doing a lacto ferment with, you know, just a simple sauerkraut, for example, this is not just one type of microbe that's undertaking this process. It's an ecological succession. And you can then taste, you know, the chemical transformation with your own mouth. So you can just, you know, you taste it every 3 or 4 days. You can see how this is changing over time. And it's a reminder that we live our lives. The whole biosphere is made up of very slow, some fast, some slow, ecological cycles. It's chemical transformations taking place.
And so, I mean, basically what you're saying is that yeast is yet another kind of fungus that we haven't really talked about yet.
Yeah, yeast is another fungus, but also that yeast doesn't do its work all by itself. There are other bacterial populations, and there may be different types of yeast if you do a wild fermented alcohol rather than adding yeast bought in a packet. So you're dealing with populations here.
So you've done a lot of experimenting with this. I mean, what, you just kind of throw together different ingredients and see what comes out and what tastes good?
It depends. Some things I've made before and I really liked, and I'd make again. Meads, for example. I like making dry meads.
Mead is made from honey, right?
Honey, yeah. So you'd get some honey and you'd dilute it with water and add a few bits of, you know, different things depending on how you're going to make it. But then, and then let it ferment.
You also write about how you sometimes go back to historical texts. I mean, what people wrote about, I mean, the fermented drinks they made, you know, hundreds, maybe even thousands of years ago, and you try to reproduce what they made.
Yes. I mean, this I find a really fascinating process because yeasts were only described as a biological organism in the 19th century, and yet humans have worked with yeast for an unknowably long time. In these old brewing recipes, yeasts were a kind of silent companion. They were an invisible participant in human culture. And by brewing these texts into being, it felt like I could somehow come closer to what life might have been like. If you're practicing history, you do a lot of reading of documents. But for me, this was another way of interpreting documents without, you know, not just reading it, but brewing it into being, brewing it into flavor, brewing it into taste. And then you get all sorts of strange results. Some of them taste amazing. Some of them taste strange. Some of them have different sort of effects on you. Some make you excitable. Some make you laugh. Some make you drowsy. And many of these were medicinal.
So are some of these historical brews that you have recreated, are they totally different from any of the alcohol that we would buy now?
Some of them, yes. Especially the beers. I made a gruit ale. They were a type of beer made from many different things, but I was making them from bog myrtle and yarrow. And we think of beer as being made of hops and barley. But hops are... It was only in the 17th century that hops became a staple part of beers. Before that, hops were one herb among many that people could use to create a bitter flavor in the beer, a bitterness to cut the sort of sweet roundedness of the malt. But hops have various roles within herbal medicine. I mean, hops help you go to sleep. They're a cousin of cannabis. And they're something that relaxes you.
So we've talked about how the consumption of this kind of alcohol will change your mind. And of course, there is a very notable way that fungi can change human consciousness, and that's through psychedelic mushrooms, psilocybin, which can, you know, quite literally blow your mind. And I understand why humans would be so attracted to psychedelic mushrooms, but why would mushrooms have this capacity? I mean, what's in it for the mushrooms?
It's a great question without a great answer. What's interesting is that the fungi that produce psilocybin, there's a gene cluster that the fungi need to produce psilocybin, not just one gene. But this gene cluster has been passed between fungal lineages by what's called horizontal gene transfer, which suggests that it has adaptive value to the fungi that could produce psilocybin. Now, the question is, I think the original question is, what is that adaptive value?
Yeah, why would the mushrooms want to, you know, have this capacity to, you know, affect not just humans, but animals also who would be eating their mushrooms?
The short answer is no one knows. And the speculation is that when the ability to produce psilocybin came about, the fungi that produced it were living in close quarters with lots of insects and insects that might eat or compete with these fungi. And that the psilocybin might have helped deter insect fungivores by taking their minds off their next meal. Or
the insects are getting high.
killing their appetites, generally befuddling them. So that's one possibility. But then another possibility, because lots of insects today can eat psilocybin mushrooms no problem and don't seem to suffer any ill effects. So if it was a deterrent, it doesn't seem to be very effective. And so it's possible that it could also have served somehow as a lure to attract certain types of insect to help the mushroom spread their spores. It could have been both at once, of course. It could have attracted some insects and repelled others. That's a sort of consensus speculation about the earliest days of psilocybin. But of course, there's a long time since then. That's about 75 million years ago. I mean, with humans, the fate of psilocybin mushrooms has transformed in just the last 60 to 70 years, when an American scientist called Richard Schultes went and described psilocybin mushroom use among the Mazatec people in Mexico. This catalyzed a big part of what we think of as the 60s psychedelic counterculture and everything that have sprung from there. So when Schultes described maybe one or two species that could produce psilocybin, now we know of nearly 200 that can produce psilocybin because of the great interest. And these species are being cultivated, grown on windowsills, in closets, in warehouses in Holland, transported around the world. And there's a new story of domestication underway. And it just shows you how quickly the evolutionary fortunes of relationships can transform.
Yeah. Well, speaking of psilocybin and evolution, I have to ask you about the stoned ape theory, which was formulated by Terence McKenna, who you knew, I know, as a child. Your family was friends with him. And he had this idea that somehow the evolution of human consciousness goes hand in hand with the consumption of magic mushrooms by our ancient ancestors. Can you explain that theory?
Yeah. So there are a number of different versions of it, but I think at its core is that between about 3 million years ago and about 200,000 years ago, when recognizable humans first appear in the fossil record, there's a huge increase in brain size. And so in a 3 million year sprint, our brains, I think they quadrupled or quintupled in size. It's a remarkable, very noticeable trend. And so the question is why? So people have all sorts of theories. A very commonly accepted one is that it's to do with our domestication of fire and the cooking of food. Because once we start cooking food, then we can acquire a lot more energy from a given amount of food. We have to spend less time foraging for food, looking for food, finding food. And we also have to spend less bodily energy digesting it, which means that our brains, which are enormously hungry, metabolically speaking, our brains weigh 2% of our body mass, but take 20% of our energy at rest. This allowed us to feed these very hungry brains. I think this is very persuasive. But Terence's view was that this boom in brain size had been caused by people eating magic mushrooms, which brought about profound changes in their experience, mystical experiences, which opened them up to completely new ways of knowing, perceiving, and communicating. And that what we think of as modern humanity has its roots in these ancient psychedelic experiences. I think the stoned ape hypothesis is something that we are unlikely to be able to prove either way. I have a lot of time for the idea that psychedelics have played an important role in our evolution, because they play an important role wherever we see them used today. And they play an important role in almost every traditional society that we know of. So human intoxication is definitely not a new thing. So quite exactly what role they had to play, though, remains a mystery. You know, we think about natural and cultural evolution as if they were separate, but they can actually be connected. Like, you can imagine a situation where where a hominin ate a load of magic mushrooms and then had the idea to domesticate fire, and then that domestication of fire led to a whole cascade of biological changes.
Because we do know, I mean, from so much personal testimony that, I mean, having a psychedelic experience, I mean, it can be terrible, but can also kind of break open your mind so that you can see things in new ways. I mean, it can be a powerful creative force.
Definitely. And we know that psychedelics have been powerful creative forces in human societies all over the world for as long as we have records. So it seems clear to me that the psychedelics have played a very important part. Whether they were responsible for this brain boom or not remains an open question.
Now, it's worth pointing out that you knew Terence McKenna when you were young. You also knew Paul Stamets, who is, well, not only a great expert on mushrooms, but also a sort of a proselytizer of the transformative power of psilocybin. You've known these people. I mean, they were friends of your family. And I mean, given that kind of personal background, one would assume that you've had a certain amount of personal experience with psychedelic mushrooms. Is that something you talk about?
Well, in 2004 and 2005, there was a loophole in the law discovered in England where it turned out that it was legal to sell fresh psilocybin mushrooms. If they were dried, they became a class A or Schedule 1 equivalent. If they were fresh, they could be sold legally. And so there was a really remarkable period of time when big crates of magic mushrooms were being sold on high streets. And during this period, I grew them at home and I experimented with them and had a number of really fascinating and transformative experiences.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it. So for someone listening to our conversation and maybe not wanting to go down the road of psychedelics, which of course are illegal in most places, how would you suggest people get closer to fungi?
Well, there are many ways. It depends on your temperament. All plants depend on fungi that live in their shoots and in their leaves and in their roots, and depend on the soil created by fungal decomposition. And so any process of gardening will be in part a fungal process. And then there's mushrooms, of course, and growing mushrooms is a great way to get a better feel for fungi. And watching them grow is a remarkable thing. And they grow so fast, you can almost watch them grow. And mushroom grow kits are readily available. You can just spray them with water. And then you can watch these forms erupt over the course of a few days. And then you can eat them, of course, afterwards, which is which is a great way to do it. Or going outside looking for mushrooms. There's no foraging. Whether or not you pick the mushrooms, you're just going outside and opening yourself to the mushrooms that you might otherwise just pass by. Soil and composting is another great way. You know, anything that involves decomposition and fermentation, which is a kind of controlled decomposition, or domesticated decomposition, a rehousing of rot. So those are just a few.
Mm-hmm. One final question, going back to eating mushrooms. Do you have favorite mushrooms you like to eat?
I'm terrible with favorites. And there are so many, so many mushrooms to choose from.
Just because, I mean, you know, when we go to the supermarket, there's a very limited range. And I'm wondering, what else we should be looking for?
I'll tell you a couple of mushrooms that I was most recently grateful for. One was shiitakes. I had some shiitakes last night, which I love. They're very easily cultivated and you can find them in many grocery stores. And maitake, which I had last week, which are also fantastically good to eat. Other great ones, the lion's mane is great to eat as well. And depending on where you are right now, in spring, there'll be St. George's mushrooms in England. There'll be morels in various parts of the world. I wish I could be actually in England right now looking for them. But
yeah. This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great to chat.
That's Merlin Sheldrake, a biologist and the author of Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures. This interview is part of our podcast series on kinship with the more than human world, which is produced by, to the best of our knowledge, in partnership with the Center for Humans and Nature, and with support from the Calliopeia Foundation. Our sound designer is Sarah Hopeful, and I'm Steve Paulson. If you want to find more in our kinship series, go to ttbook.org/kinship, where you'll see all our podcast episodes and also a lot of great essays. Thanks for joining us.